Hello and welcome to Neo Bohemia. I'm your host, Charlie Layton.
And I'm your guest, Jennifer Harder, a.k.a. Blonde Thunder from Blonde Thunder Presents. And my listeners will remember Charlie as the sometimes announcer of my podcast.
Today's episode is about the subject of integrity. What it's like to have personal integrity as an artist, how one navigates the business maintaining their personal integrity, the jobs you take, specifically about performing artists today. It's interesting because circumstances spurred us to talk about integrity more than expertise.
Right, and circumstances also have us recording in a park.
We're recording in a park, yes. So Jennifer is an actor. We met
during freshman orientation in 1998.
Yeah, as acting students at NYU on the first day and then on the last day of graduation. Yeah. I didn't see you throughout the...
But I heard of you. Right. You were quite the rock star in the Atlantic.
Oh, please.
Oh, you're a rock star.
But Jennifer is a distinguished actor. She won a New York Theater...
Oh, yes.
New York Innovative Theater Award.
Mm-hmm. For best... Well, you're not supposed to say best. You're supposed to say outstanding. Outstanding actress in a supporting role.
She's an actor. She's a distinguished musician. She plays the trumpet in several bands.
Yeah, and it really runs the gamut. I mean, I do indie rock. I'm in a brass band. Like, call it a marching band. Sometimes we march. Sometimes we just... stand and play.
Hungry March Band.
I toured with a political punk band. I toured with Gogol Bordello as well, gypsy punk. I have done steampunk. That's an interesting one. Steampunk. And that actually goes into what we're going to talk about later.
And you were also in a pirate band.
Oh, yes. You and I were both in the pirate band. Yes. And we also had a vaudeville act, too, which we might reprise depending on circumstances, money, and drive.
Yes.
And inspiration.
Jennifer was... going to be the person I was going to ask to talk about the theme of hustle or initiative, because more than anyone I know, she works. She puts herself out there. She just recently started her own podcast.
Right.
You've been in your first... You finished your first season.
I did. It was actually through Radio Free Brooklyn, and I used their studio. Now I'm going to do it on my own, and this is going to be episode number one.
Woo!
Of my new season, so thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. So Jennifer is a working musician and actor, and she also was integral in me meeting my wife.
Oh, that's right.
Because you helped me get the job with Cynthia Von Bueller.
Yes.
Where
yes.
Rachel was working with. Speakeasy Dollhouse.
There we go. Speakeasy Dollhouse.
So the subject of integrity came forth out of circumstance. Jenny approached me about a job, a gig that I wanted to take. You care to elaborate?
Well, I wanted to give you money.
Well, thank you.
What happened was many years ago, I would say about 3.5 years ago, somebody came to the Speakeasy Dollhouse, and let's just say the audience was wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
The audience for that particular show...
upscale clientele.
Yeah. People who could afford $16 to $18 cocktails all night long.
Okay.
People who didn't really... they weren't in it for the artistic value. They were in it to see and be seen, to put on their fanciest duds.
Have an experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so when they would actually speak to us after the show, they were fascinated that I had a gig afterwards, that you had a show afterwards. Like,
yeah.
Even one time, we performed the after party there, and people really wanted to talk about us and our careers and so on and so forth. So I met this guy, and he was like, listen... I'm a real estate agent, and my colleague is on a Bravo show. It's a reality competition show called Million Dollar Listing. It's very popular, because I had never heard of it.
Right.
But he was like, I think that maybe he could sell a Tribeca apartment for $10 million if we had a speakeasy party. And so he got me in touch with the casting people for Bravo and basically said, sure, but we don't have much of a budget. And I wasn't able to cast you because...
Why is that hard to believe?
Oh my God, reality shows are nuts. They tried to get us to work for free.
Right.
And only two of my friends would. One of them was Yao, who was the sketch artist in Speakeasy Dollhouse, because she wanted to prove to the Chinese government that she was working really hard and deserved to get her visa. So she worked for free. And now, oh my gosh, she's doing so well. I think she's only 26, and she did the illustration for Katy Perry's Dark Horse single.
Wow.
Yep, and she has a meme that's going completely viral. It's blowing up. And I think the title of it is Stop Saying You're Sorry.
Wow.
I don't know if you've seen it.
So this speakeasy party for her was just a starting point.
Yeah, for a great career.
Yeah.
My other friend who's, you know, she was just starting the acting business and she wanted to be seen on TV. Fine. But for the rest of us, like, hustling type nightlife people, I wanted to get paid a good rate. I think what they offered us was around $300.
Mm-hmm.
And that was for 2.5 hours, which is fine. It's not great, but it's fine for a non-union thing. Okay, so fast forward several years, the same real estate agent contacts me and said, listen, that was such a successful thing. And it was, because people in the Midwest keep telling me, like, oh my God, I saw your episode again on Million Dollar Listing or whatever that is. I even saw it when I was taking a flight, I think, across to LA, and they were showing Bravo shows, and that episode came up. So it's a very popular one.
Yeah.
So this real estate agent guy said, I have a building in... what's the neighborhood that's right by Brooklyn Museum?
Crown Heights.
Yeah, Crown Heights. I have a building in Crown Heights where we have 9 units that are being converted into condos, and we're going to have like a launch party for all the interested buyers, and we want to have a theme. And we thought, how about a speakeasy? Or maybe...
they invited buyers, or were they inviting agents? Or?
They were inviting potential condo owners.
Right.
A lot of agents from the agency were there.
Okay.
But they had, you know, they had a woman in a tiny hat and a very tight corset who was doing whiskey tasting, and she had a ukulele player with her. And then he said, you know, I'll pay you a little extra if you hire all of your, you know, top-notch friends. So I was able to get one of my favorite magicians, favorite piano players, and also a really high-end jazz trio. Jason Prover from the Hot Sardines has his own, you know, couple of bands, and I was able to get them hired.
So this was a gig.
And then you and me, and this was a pretty well-paying gig. I think it for 2 hours it paid, depending on the skill, it paid between $300 to $400, and I had an extra couple hundred because I was the point person.
Right, and to the layperson, we would describe this as a corporate gig.
Yeah.
So a corporate gig in that you do it to be compensated.
Oh, in fact, one of the magicians I reached out to quoted me $1,200 as his corporate rate. You know, so when I said, listen, we only have 400 in the budget, he was like, well, good luck with that, because for corporate gigs, for my integrity, I'll only do it for over 1,000.
Wow.
And there are a lot of corporations that do hire.
And they get that, too.
Yeah, they do.
So we did this gig. This was about a week ago. And lo and behold, on the internets, later that week, on the cover of a web mag called Brooklyn.com, a reputable web mag that focuses on cheap living in Brooklyn, free events around town, cheap apartments, and fostering a life of affordable living.
Fun frugality.
Fun frugality, we can call it. And all over some of the Facebook feeds. All over my feed.
Social media all over. Somebody alerted me on Twitter. I don't even go on Twitter, and I found a notification saying, what are you doing? Are you gentrifying? I was like, what are you talking about? And then I saw this.
Right. There was a picture of Jenny and I in our vaudeville garb. I in a straw boater hat that I tend to wear in the summer. Vest and tie, and Jenny in a very cute polka dot dress with her trumpet, smiling as we would for a camera naturally. Under the title of the article saying, Signs You May Be a Brooklyn Gentrifier, which they later changed to explain a little more. But we were the poster children for nefarious gentrification in Crown Heights all of a sudden. We were caught in the crossfire of the dealings of this condo.
Yeah, it's such a cheesy shot of us. I mean, we look so clean, so young, so silly. I mean, it was basically easy to make fun of that picture. And we were smiling. Well, you weren't really smiling, but I was like smiling to beat the band because I thought it was the actual photographer who was hired by them. And it could have been. There were actually 2 different photographers who took a picture. I'm not actually sure if they got it off the official press packet or what.
Right. And the caption of the photo reads, Dance the Dance of Gentrification.
Oh.
So we became the unwitting mascots of gentrification because we... were spotted performing at a corporate gig, the dealings of which were completely out of our hands.
But I started to think that things were a little not above the board when one of the tenants came to the piano player and said, oh, did you know there's a bed bug infestation and you really should not play this event?
Right.
And so I went to the point person and I was like, hey, are there bed bugs here? And he said, no, she's just a crazy person who doesn't want the condos to happen.
Right.
And I thought, well, gosh, it's 10 minutes to showtime. It's not like I'm going to stop now. I have a contract.
And if you read the article, look it up in Brooklyn, they are talking about, I mean, I think they're in earnest with their hearts in the right place trying to fight back against gentrification. And this is the type of gentrification that Jenny and I would not be nearly a part of. They're talking about, you know, what do you call it?
It was like $750,000 for a one bedroom.
Yeah, flipping a three bedroom that was $3,600 into half a million.
Yeah.
Something absurd,
right.
Absurd price gouging and flipping.
Right. And also, you know, pushing out people who have been there a long time, people who are part of the community, changing the face of the actual neighborhood to the face of people with money. And that's sick.
And that's that's something that's happening all over the city. It's unavoidable. It's happening and at a rapid rate. Thankfully, de Blasio put a rent freeze for this year so that no new rates can... You can't... they were at a stable rate for 2016. At least that's what I assigned. And the thing that baffled me a little bit was that the article was directly conflating gentrification with steampunk, which, sure, maybe, no, not really, because...
I think that it's that age-old problem I have specifically as a young woman with, like, cutesy bangs who plays an instrument, and I do live in Williamsburg, they call me a hipster.
Right.
You know, it's these labels that you put on artists. I never have been a hipster. I think of hipsters having expendable cash, not a lot of conviction, and going with fashion.
Trust funds.
And also, yes, trust funds and things like that. I mean, I've been scraping by. I have a career that I'm proud of, but I think that I'm pretty much at the poverty level.
Interestingly enough, you posted your yearly income on Parade Magazine.
I did, in the 2016 issue of What People Really Earn.
Yes.
I'm on the same page as Amy Poehler.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then it's crazy. She's earning, like, you know, millions of dollars, and here I am with $12,500.
Right.
And granted, $12,500 is what I made from art last year, and it was a banner year for me. I had a Super Bowl commercial, and I had a North American tour with a very prolific band. And still, $12,500 was all I made. So I have to supplement that with, I'm a secretary in my spare time, and sometimes I do people's accounting. But it's still, I'm still at the poverty line. Even before Obamacare happened, I was getting Medicaid, if that's, you know.
I believe I'm slightly above, but I qualify for full benefits.
Yeah, we're broke. We are broke. We are the people reading Brooklyn.
We are the subject.
We are the choir they're preaching to.
Yes.
And we're their audience.
And we were made the whipping boy.
Yeah.
For accepting a paying gig.
Right.
And so the question we bring to our listeners is the question of integrity.
Right.
Are we sacrificing our personal artistic integrity to accept a paying gig from a realty company that is clearly acting to gentrify a neighborhood?
Mm-hmm.
And at what point is that responsibility on them or on us?
And, yeah. And just this morning, you and I were awarded a grant.
Right.
We were awarded a grant from a community organization called the Bindlestiff Family Circus. They're amazing. They teach children. They entertain people. They are a bit anarchist. They're just awesome. They've been around for about 20 years now. And they have very tiny little grants that every year on the 1st of May, on May Day, they give to a local act that needs it. And
right.
This year, you and I won.
Congratulations.
And honestly, well, yes, but you know what it amounts to? The exact amount of money that I got from that corporate gig.
Right. Of course.
So you...
You could write a grant. You could just expect it to come once a year and get it one time.
Right. Or you can make it in 2 hours from a corporation.
Right. So this article was pretty snarky and incendiary and
before we actually talk to the CEO of Brooklyn, I should read it again.
Okay.
But I will say that when I saw it posted on Twitter, I'm not a real Twitter person. I've never actually twatted at anyone. I'm not sure how it works. So I pushed the respond button and I was like, hey, Brooklyn, I don't really appreciate this. I think maybe you should use a picture of the real estate agents instead.
Right.
No response.
The headline could have read, gentrifying landlord throws themed party.
Yeah.
As opposed to signs you're a gentrifier. Or
right.
Conflating steampunk or vaudeville with being a gentrifier.
Or you and me with being a gentrifier.
Right. Or us being the cover photo. Right.
Although my name is Jen, so gentrification might be my new character. Maybe I got something good out of this.
Yes, possibly.
So I tweeted at him like 4 times. Another time was, "Hey, Brooklyn, you know I played your event in 2014
right.
with one of my bands."
So Jenny is an equal opportunity trumpet performer.
I am. I actually played their event. And then I also, you know, linked that Parade magazine article to them, and I said, "Listen, do you still think I'm the face of gentrification if I'm making $12,500 from my chosen profession each year?"
Yeah.
And I also, in Blonde Thunder Presents, just my last episode in the Career Changes episode, I gave them a shout out. And now I felt bad about it. My guest actually said, "I'm so happy to have met the CEO of Brooklyn because I wrote an article for him and that jump-started my career."
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm just like, I feel kind of trod upon.
Right.
And I'm not really that upset. I am a good-natured person, but at the same time, I'm just a little miffed.
All press is good press.
Right. Well, that's what I'm trying to do today.
Right. So the silver lining out of all of this is that Tim has agreed to interview us.
Yes.
And talk about being a working artist.
Yes, Tim Donnelly. And I don't know his background. I should have done some research, I guess. It's going to come out in the conversation. But Tim Donnelly is the CEO of Brooklyn, and he was a little apologetic in the email, but not really. Because he kind of was just like, "Well, you took the gig. You're in the press packet. Why shouldn't we?" You know, that was kind of his line of argument there.
Right.
But he is going to interview us for his site about the choices we make.
Sure.
You know?
So, before we get into that very shortly, can you briefly describe the last 15 years since out of college, what it was like for you as an artist trying to survive?
Well, first of all, I had to get out of debt. I worked as a video production coordinator for over a year for a boutique agency doing industrial videos. And it was corporate. It was so corporate. It was for AXA Financial. It was for M&M Mars. It was for JP Morgan Chase, as it was called at the time. MasterCard. You know, all these different agencies, we would do really boring industrial videos for them, like don't sexually harass your coworkers and diversity in the workplace and intellectual property security videos, stuff like that. It paid quite well.
Nice.
Yeah. And then so I was out of debt and I didn't want to do that anymore. I wanted to get a part-time job because I'm an artistic type. I really just can't sit at any one thing 8 hours a day like most of America is pressured to do.
Right.
I don't think that American economy is set up for freelancers at all. It's definitely not.
Not in regards to insurance,
no.
Overtime.
Mm-mm, none of that. Unions even.
Unions.
So I started doing secretarial work. I was a church secretary in Park Slope. That was kind of nice. It was local. I've worked...
So you've always had a security job alongside...
Always.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never been unemployed. I've always had another source of income because I'm prudent like that. I don't want to ever be destitute.
Have you lived in New York since graduation? Did you ever move away?
Oh, yeah. There was about 2 years on and off that I lived in Ireland. But even over there, I had a job from the day that I got off the plane. I went right to a job interview. So I've always been working.
This is the hustle I was describing.
Yeah. And I'm always making my own shows. I had a theater company for many years.
Did the security jobs, the day jobs, did they ever segue into artistic fulfillment?
No.
So you had them separate?
Yes.
Right. And that seems to be a life path for, I would say, almost the majority of New York artists, that they have to have a day job until they can phase out the day job and start making a living off of being an artist.
Yep.
Because of exorbitant rents that aren't prevented.
Because of gentrification.
Because of gentrification, yes. So what were some of the earliest artistic projects you started?
Well, with my theater company, we actually started in Jersey City because that's where we got space. It was the Archdiocese of Jersey City, I think, that gave us space. And the weird thing about that was that they actually told us that we could not do certain shows because they were too risque.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew that we had to get out of there, not just because it was Jersey and a lot of people were not going there yet, but also because we wanted to have artistic freedom. So then we started working with Horse Trade, and Horse Trade is fantastic. At the time, they owned 3 spaces and a rehearsal space. It was Under St. Mark's, the Crane Theater, the Red Room, and then Fanfare, which is just a rehearsal spot. and it was wonderful. We were associate artists there. We would sell tickets and work in the office sometimes, you know, for a quota, and then we would get like 25 hours of free space, and then we would get a cut at the door. It was a really good setup, and we were able to really grow there. By the time we left that position, we had gotten the New York Times to review a few of our shows. And I remember even celebrities were coming to our shows at that point. I think, oh, who's the guy who played the fly? What's his name? Jeff Goldblum.
Jeff Goldblum.
Jeff Goldblum even came front and center to one of the shows where I was playing a gigantic talking chicken. And
that's the one you won the NYITU.
Exactly. That was my sort of claim to fame at one point was, hey, you're the chicken. Yeah, the chicken.
So what was the first musical gig you took in New York?
My first musical endeavor in New York, besides all of the bands at NYU, because I was in the Pet Band, like symphony orchestra, concert band.
Wow.
We would play for graduation in boater straw hats. Yeah, I put my horn down after that. I didn't pick it up back up again until I was working at the Brick Theater. And the Brick Theater has a very strong community. I really like the people who do shows there. And they have a rock band that's kind of like the resident indie rock band. It's just kind of a side project, but it's lovely. I love the music. I don't join any band that I don't already love their music. The band was called Supermajor, and the lead singer is Adam Swiderski. So it was a really, it was a nice, loving, warm band to start off in, but it didn't pay ever. It never paid a single dollar. And in fact, I had to pay to be in that band because the rehearsal space cost like $12 an hour or something.
Right.
Because, you know, you need a drum set and you need to plug into the amps and so on and so forth. Whereas now I'm in a bunch of bands that are acoustic and we can just play in parks.
Yeah.
You know?
Park bands, outdoor acoustic bands save a lot of money.
Yep.
Except in the winter.
Oh, right. Yeah. Then you just have to annoy your neighbors because you're practicing in your living room.
Right. I know that story. So aside from Supermajor, would you care to rattle off the many bands you've been a part of?
So in the indie rock vein, I'm currently, because I'm not in Supermajor anymore, I left it to join Hungry March Band. Hungry March Band is fun, and it's been around for almost 2 decades, and they're like an anarchist marching band. We'll play anything from Occupy Wall Street to sometimes, you know, corporate gigs, and sometimes birthday
heavens
parties.
Forfend.
I know. Indie rock, I'm currently in Balthrop, Alabama, and I love them. They are like, they're like a southern Arcade Fire.
Okay.
Like, there's like 12 people on stage playing the banjo and the mandolin and the electric guitar and the accordion and Barry Sax. And we all have fake names because we're all in the town of Balthrop, Alabama. And so my fake name is Daphne Summerdale.
That's sweet.
But yeah, we dress up in like overalls and linen dresses, and it's a thing. It's definitely twee. It's definitely hipster seeming. Okay, I'll grant you that, but it's great music.
You've also toured with Outer National.
Outer National, yeah, that was, it is like if you take the Clash with their dub undertones and put mariachi tones over top of it, you get Outer National.
Whoa.
And Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine and Audioslave, he produces them. He produced all their albums with Warner Music. And a band like that, they're full of integrity. They just want to preach about how everyone should be, you know, a socialist utopia and how the revolution's coming, but they really didn't focus on money at all.
Really?
And that's why I left, because I just couldn't.
I just couldn't make a living.
Yeah, I can't tour constantly with no place to live and no relationships. It's hard. But that did segue into me touring with Gogol Bordello for their 10th anniversary Gypsy Punk tour. I met them in the Czech Republic, and they go way back. Those two bands actually like met in Mehenata, mm-hmm. the Lower East Side. But that was the best of both worlds. You got a great message of unity and world peace and party, 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 and everybody, you know, working together. But you also have a label behind them, money for necessities and amenities. You have a little bit of comfort so you can actually continue to thrive as an artist instead of merely subsist. And I'd rather thrive as an artist.
That's great. I'd also like to mention the bands that I was fortunate enough and have been fortunate enough to collaborate with Jenny in. Bathtub Jen and the Henchmen, the Squeaky Cleans, and Skull Buggery, the pirate band that plays aboard a sailing schooner.
Yeah, that was actually a lot of fun. That was a lot of work.
Yes.
That was a lot of work because you were basically doing all the orchestrations. you know?
We were trying to put together a list of sea shanties. And then also with that, we were tour guides in the days.
I loved that. That was a lot of work too, but that paid off. That was doing historical tours of the New York Harbor on the two-masted schooner. So it was a lot of like Ellis Island stories, a lot of Gangs of New York stories, Statue of Liberty, Governor's Island, Brooklyn Bridge, all of that. Which, I mean, we could still do, but it's just that we can't do it on that ship anymore. They either ran out of money or they ran out of interest, but I thought we were doing a pretty good job. And I got a tan. That was a really good summer.
That was a great summer.
Up next, Jen and I will interview Tim Donnelly from Brooklyn.com. My apologies for the sound quality. We recorded at Dixon Place in the Lower East Side.
So let me ask you, what is your name? You're
Tim.
Tim.
Yeah.
Tim Donnelly.
Yeah.
And you are chief editor of Brooklyn?
Editor-in-chief.
Editor-in-chief of the web mag, Brooklyn.com.
Okay.
And from here on out, he will be asking the questions.
Okay, so. I see you already started recording.
Such a good announcer voice, Charlie.
Thank you.
I'll just start my thing. So let me get the basics. So you guys, where do you live?
I live in Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
Okay.
I got a crazy good deal, and it makes me feel like I'm actually going places in life. Mm. So, living alone for the first time, and I just turned 35.
Yeah. It's a big difference, right?
It's a huge difference, but if you actually, like, you know, if you looked at the link for the Parade magazine thing, my income for art is $12,500 a year, so my rent is $800 a month. So I'm like just scraping by. I've never had to pay more than $900 a month for rent.
Mm-hmm.
As long as I've ever been in the city, which is we've been here, we moved in on the same day about 17 and a half years ago.
Mm-hmm.
98, September of 98.
Okay, so you've got the roots.
Yeah. I don't know if you call them roots. I miss the crazy East Village.
Yeah. I live in Hamilton Heights.
Okay. Which is trending these days, real estate-wise, I hear.
Yes, and my ex-girlfriend's social worker, when I told her I moved there, she's like, oh, you live in the White Heights now. And at that time, it was 7 years ago when it was not that, but she could see it coming. She could see foresee the changes.
So you guys are obviously doing music and whatnot, but what do you have a primary source of income, or do you just kind of patch gigs together?
Yeah, I just patch stuff together. I'm like a bona fide hustler. Last year, as I was saying in our introduction, but I'll repeat it for Brooklyn. I had a banner year last year. I had a Super Bowl commercial. I toured with Gogo Bordello.
Right.
And then we had a continuous summer gig on a two-masted schooner, which was really fun and steady. So, and then, like, I have my other bands, as you know. I just have, like, steady little gigs here and there, like, three times a month. So I actually was doing okay last year. And then I work once a week doing medical billing for a psychoanalyst.
Mm-hmm. What are you, Charlie?
I have been very, very fortunate that I was hired by the school that I went to right after graduation, because I was a TA for my speech teacher, and I've always had a little bit of part-time work teaching speech at the Atlantic Theater Company.
Mm-hmm. Check out his diction.
And from that, I mean, I had other jobs to scrape by. I was walking dogs pretty steadily full-time while I taught part-time, but also I've been a very diverse musician. I play over 14 instruments. And at one point or another, through the last 15 years I've lived here, I've been paid to teach them, to play them. I've been paid in bands, various bands of all different types of music. So I'm very lucky that I diversify. And that's helped sustain me more than the acting gigs or the vaudeville gigs or...
Mm-hmm. Well, even that's diversification. I mean, he and I have a... degrees in drama, straight up drama, not musical theater.
Right.
And then after a while, I actually, because I'm a big fan of burlesque and the variety arts and circus arts and sideshow arts and all that, I was like, wow, if you do theater in a setting with alcohol, you get paid more.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we entered the vaudeville scene, because we're like, oh, well, why don't we do that? We've got the skills necessary. We can get more money if we do it for the night crowd.
Right, and the variety aspect of it caters to doing skits, playing music,
and accents and dialects.
Accents and dialects. I've gotten more work as an accordionist who does
accents than I've ever gotten as a straight-up actor.
Really?
Yeah.
Totally. I get paid more to play the trumpet semi-okay than I do to act well, because I think that there are many more blondes who look like me acting than there are playing the trumpet.
Yeah. So. Do you have a favorite instrument to play?
Right now it's the accordion.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why is that your favorite right now?
It just took over. I got more gigs doing it, so it took up most of my time, but I started out on guitar, piano, bass. I just hung up my upright bass because the Boogie Woogie band that I was playing with left town.
Were they called Boss Chops?
Mark and the Boss Chops. Mark went to Nashville, I believe. He's on a tour.
Mm.
So I haven't picked up a big old upright in about a year. But I can jump back in.
I love it. We did a sketch for the Clown Festival where he just kept coming out. It was in the middle of a fight scene and he just kept coming out with a different instrument. At one point, he doesn't even play trombone, but he came out with the trombone.
I learned the trombone.
I learned clarinet for the Hava Nagila sketch. It was crazy.
I mean, I'm good with my hands, and my mother always bought me these used or cheap or broken instruments from pawn shops, and I would learn how to repair them or I'd upgrade them over time. But we never got lessons. So I had to teach myself how to play all these instruments.
How do you like harpo?
I guess,
did that with the harp. He was self-taught.
Harpo.
Yeah.
So how often do you get a gig that's kind of like this one that we wrote about? That's
the corporate one?
Yeah, because I know, I've seen your resumes and your website, like things that you guys do. How often does something come along that is like, that you might consider, I guess, a corporate gig?
I'm so happy when a corporate gig comes along because they pay a living wage.
Yeah.
But it, I mean, 4 to 5 times a year, if that. Sometimes just 3. Well, no, I would say 4 to 5 times a year.
Jenny was just mentioning that she is the recipient of a grant that pays the same amount of money that she got paid to do that gig.
Yep. Okay.
$500.
Yeah. So one yearly, once a year, the Bindlestow Family Circus gives out the First of May Award. It's, you know, it's very anarchist, it's very, you know, it's full of integrity, it's for the art, and it pays exactly what I got paid in 2 hours from the real estate agency.
Mm-hmm.
They must have money, right? They must. Like, I was very excited to get my friends hired at a rate that will pay their utility bills. I was really happy, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So,
how many people did you get a gig for?
Let's see, I got a jazz trio, I got a pianist, I got a magician, I got a photographer, and I got us. So all in all, that was 8 hired. Mm-hmm. Even though I pitched double that. I pitched a lot of people to them, and I was hoping to get the pirate band. I was hoping to get some acro.
And you had to go to a second magician because the first wanted quadruple digits.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of these professional circus artists have corporate rates, and the corporate rates are like $1,200 for 1 hour, which was not their budget. I was like, their budget was, you know, several hundred an hour, and the guy totally passed it up. He said, no, if I'm going to work for a corporation, no. He was in that position, and I don't know his position, but that particular magician was like, no, only for over 1,000 will I do the...
Gotta get something out of it.
Yeah, so.
And when you take a gig like that, are you excited? Are you so excited about the payday that you just take it, or do you look into what the company's all about? Do you find anything out about them?
I mean, I knew him from before, and I just kind of thought, no, I didn't think about it. No.
Personally, I just look at what my end of the responsibility is in this capacity. If I'm there to play music, I'll just show up, I'll play music, get my check, and get out.
Yeah, I won't do nudity. I usually, anything that has my voice on it, I usually want to have some kind of creative control. But they didn't say they were going to record us.
As far as we were told, we were just the ambient music or the performance of a party.
Right. They actually changed our location to the greeting area. Probably because we were too loud, I don't know.
In the lobby building? Yeah, okay. So what's that like to be in that situation where you're... I mean, it wasn't like there's a ton of people in the building coming to you with that, but, you know, obviously there's some tension there with these condos that you're helping sell ostensibly that the people who live in the building don't want or don't want to see you know, turned into condos in the first
place.
I felt
silly, to tell you the truth. I kind of felt silly in the lobby doing it. And I mean, in the picture that you used was very silly. It was a very silly thing we were doing. And usually we're doing it for an audience who is appreciative. You know, usually we're at a steampunk convention where it's like, wow, yes, we want you playing the Star Wars Cantina theme in our conference room or whatever. I thought that we got a little bit of bemused expressions by the people who live there.
Mm-hmm.
Like smirks, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the clientele like who was coming in to look at the building?
Mixed. I would say young professionals of all different races. But they were young. They were professionals.
Yeah.
They were yuppies, yeah.
They were yuppies, yeah.
Yeah.
Were there a lot of people coming through?
I would say 50.
Yeah. I don't even think that the effect of our vaudeville truly resonated on them.
No.
Either. They don't know how to access it.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of a a lost in translation kind of element to it that. So
they liked us. They were like, oh, how cute. And then they just went on. And
so they're not necessarily the kind of people you would expect to be like, oh, where can I see you guys again?
We did get a couple of people coming up to us saying, what are your cards? Yeah. But honestly, we interacted more with the real estate agents, and they really liked it. So,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So part of the reason this came to a head for us, and you guys got caught in the crossfire of all this from our end, is that the company that is doing this does have a bad record of... of kicking tenants out or you know, being controversial. They got, there was a RICO suit used against them for their Uptown housing. RICO is like the racketeering laws that they used to take down like gangsters. They had to file a multi-million-dollar suit for some other housing uptown. And now this property was controversial too. Yeah, basically, and I don't know if WNYC has that gentrification podcast they've been doing, and they're actually in the last episode, after we ran that story, they're in that episode talking about how they have helped force people out of buildings and flip them into, flip low-cost housing into high-cost housing, and that sort of thing.
I think if Charlie and I were above the poverty level, I think if we weren't so hungry, we would have thought more about it.
Mm-hmm. That we had the luxury of being able to afford turning down a gig like this.
Yes, and to bring Hungry March Band into the mix, because, we played your event in 2014, and we were happy to play your event in 2014, because for us, it was like, the pay was low, but at the same time, it was like a great venue, an appreciative audience, free beer, for, what we thought the audience was going to be like, anarchist poor people, which is great. But like, sometimes we're offered gigs where members, especially the older members, say no.
I think at some point...
saying no to money. Like, some people are going to say no to money. If we did I think it was like a MasterCard or something, didn't do it. We've turned down a gig in Zuccotti Park. It was American Express wanted to do... They wanted to do River to River Fest, and they wanted us to play in Zuccotti Park as a performance area, but it was sponsored by American Express, and we said no, because we were just there 6 months prior occupying Wall Street, and we just thought that it was really sacrilegious, and they were using us to basically gentrify a sacred space for...
But at some point also, I ask, at what line do you draw the responsibility of the performers, or the caterers, or these low-level employees? Is it my responsibility to turn down paying work if I don't agree with someone else's business ethics on a level that I'm not interacting with directly?
I'll tell you, the leader of the pirate band does.
Mm-hmm.
We perform a lot with a very bohemian dude. And I think that he has enough money to say no,
Well, that's the question that I'm interested to hear you guys kind of talk out, is like, when do you, you could argue that taking that gig, just for argument's sake, would, taking the gig at the condo helps, make it harder for other people who don't have a lot of money to be able to afford to live here if you're, helping decrease the housing stock. So at what point does your, artistic bohemian ethos clash with your need to eat?
Right.
Oh, man. I think the trajectory of a career hopefully should be a nice melding of the two. Mm-hmm. I don't want to stay poor my whole life. I don't think that there is any inherent regalness to being hungry.
The nicest thing I could say about this realty company was that they hired and compensated local artists.
Okay.
That would be the silver lining for me personally. Obviously, everything else is highly questionable.
And also, to most extent, we had complete autonomy over what we performed. They didn't stifle us in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really nice to be able to be paid well for what... Mm-hmm. What thrills you? It really is, and it happens so rarely.
So what would you turn down then? What would kind of cross your line?
What would you turn down? Oh, okay. So here's the thing. I also do commercials,
mm-hmm.
and I've made it to the very last callback for two different chicken commercials, and I'm a vegan. So I was called back for Tyson Chicken as well as Popeye's Chicken. And also I did go to the callback for Chobani Yogurt for a voiceover. And I was stressing the fuck out because I don't want to support union busting franchises, and I don't want to support the horrible, you know, treatment of these chickens. And I really was so happy that I didn't get the gig because I didn't have to make that decision of whether or not I would turn it down, because honestly, I might have turned it down.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the Tyson one. They are so evil.
Right.
They are so evil. I think I would have turned that one down.
Yeah. What about each other? What's your line?
For me personally, it was really ironic that I saw your article days after this gig, because this was actually the first corporate gig I had been offered in years,
mm-hmm.
with the exception of one sort of party-themed thing that with Cynthia Von Bueller, actually. But this was the first time that I was straight up a musical corporate gig. And I remember talking to my speech class, because I had to cancel that speech class to make it there. And I said, you guys, this is a new step for me. I'm taking paying work for the purpose of getting paid. And lo and behold, the universe was in a way sort of crashing down on me and punishing, condemning me for doing something. Because I was ambivalent from the beginning, talking to my wife, who performs as well in artistic gigs and corporate gigs, and she has a hard time reconciling the artistic element of a corporate gig when you're just performing for people who have hired you specifically at the behest of a company rather than a show.
Yeah.
Or
window dressing instead of
right. Really, mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can see it in the audience reaction that their connection to you is a lot different than someone who connects with you on the level of artist, who appreciates your art from the get-go. And they can still appreciate you. But this is new territory for me, so I have yet to decide personal boundaries just yet. I love getting paid. It's taken me 15 years to get to the point that I only take paying work for all of the projects I do.
That's another kettle of fish right there,
yeah.
Is a lot of artists working for free.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I got all my exposure dollars. I earned them for 10 years.
You paid your dues.
Yeah, in the last 5 years, if the gig doesn't pay, or if it doesn't edify me, or it doesn't lead to something that pays, I'm very unlikely to take it.
You know what's interesting is, a lot of my family members and a lot of people back in the Midwest, they associate success purely with money when
right.
it comes to artistic things. So, you know, for me to do a commercial for Tyson would be awesome, because mm-hmm. I'd be, you know, making all this money and I'd have all this exposure, and that's what you're into, right? You know, so other people's definition of success doesn't even take into account
right.
artistic
yeah,
integrity.
And I was lucky that I was able to survive in the city on day jobs until all these various artistic projects, side projects, started to come to fruition. If you diversify enough things, you start to see that some of them start to pay if they develop. And if not, then you push them aside and make room for a new opportunity.
Right.
And I feel like this is something that tons of people deal with every day, is, you know, where do you, especially I think as the economy is changing and as the idea of, you know, selling out kind of morphs or changes or loses its stigma over the years or disappears, then what do you do for... just to be able to do your other passion projects, what do you do for, you know, to be able to survive?
Right. And to tell you the truth, Charlie, your expression in that photo that was used was pretty ambivalent. I had
yeah,
the shit-eating grin.
Yeah.
You looked a little ambivalent.
Yeah.
I was uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I mean, technically,
I love playing music with Jenny. I like the chances that I get to do it.
Yeah.
If I was doing it in a park for free.
Which we did for rehearsal.
All the time.
And that was actually pretty fulfilling, except for the crazy people grabbing my knee.
Right.
Oh, do you remember what happened that time we were in Tompkins Square Park and the women who were crying came over to us?
Right.
And you were playing ukulele.
Yes.
And she was crying, and I thought maybe she was crazy, because Tompkins Square Park is full of crazy people. But
and I did this Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Yeah, because she said her son had just died, and he also worked at NYU, and could you somehow remember the Hawaiian version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow?
Yeah.
And she was sobbing, and I felt like, oh my God, like, I'm so glad to be an artist right now.
Right.
Just in a park.
It's funny, because I busk anytime I get a day off, and I don't make that much money busking. Some people make a lot of money busking. I do it for the... This is stupid. I do it for the romantic experience. My goal when I'm busking is to get two people to stop and kiss. And sometimes they do, maybe they won't.
What are you playing when you busk?
Ball musette, some classical accordion stuff. But
the Amelie songs.
Amelie song, yeah. Amelie soundtrack. But if I did that, then I would consider myself a personal success. The problem with that is I get pennies or quarters. One time I got a $20 bill.
Remember when we worked for Natasha Pierre and Greg Komotavetian's Wealth?
Yes.
They hired us, producer wanted us to play in the lobby, but then he kicked us out to the street. And then he took away my instrument, and then I was like, am I Elmo? Like, I'm not gonna be handing out pamphlets.
We were sort of carnival barkers for their off-Broadway production
and
right outside of Casino.
Away, I said, no, I'm not gonna do this. That's where I drew the line there, because okay. I was like, I'm not a photo op.
Where you cease to be. You cease to be in control of your artistic expression.
Now, do you feel like someone, like, say, real estate company coming to you guys and being like, we like your steampunk vaudeville aesthetic, you know, come... Do you all feel like you're being co-opted, or like that aesthetic is being used as, like you said, window dressing, or as, you know, like a sideshow instead of being this thing that actually people are into?
I think it has very little to do with the effect of that party. It could have been a hip-hop party, it could have been a salsa party, it could have been any number of styles that they were just trying to create to make it unique. And this one happened to be steampunk. I think it might be easier to make the jump from steampunk to gentrification. It's predominantly white in America, but steampunk in Japan would be predominantly Japanese. I don't think that, I mean, and because I'm, you know, we dress up, we project the image of wealth, or just of, you'd have to have a clean suit or something to that effect.
Oh, we were totally cheesy, squeaky clean in that picture. Yeah,
yeah, it was, cheese balls.
But as two people who care about your art forms and various art forms that they are, you know, being taken out of that art form capacity and just told to come play in a lobby, like, does that feel at all like, you know, weird or co-opting?
I didn't like being in the lobby. I didn't feel comfortable, but it was just 2 hours. I felt less comfortable standing on the street corner of 42nd Street in my skimpy, you know, slutty Natasha
outfit.
Especially
when November came.
Oh my God. Do you like stories? Do you like crying? Do
1812 was great year for comets.
Little known fact. What was the other one?
What?
Pippin doesn't have pierogies.
Pierogies. Cabaret doesn't have caviar.
Oh, we did such a good job on, they didn't even notice.
Right, and we really tried to inhabit as much of Russia as we could possibly muster. I played Kalinka, I played Katushka, we played Bubamara, which is Romanian.
I even learned a Gogol Bordello tune for the first time with you.
Yeah.
But even that was just a co-opt of a folk song, Start Wearing Purple. That's just the easiest.
Huh. Yeah. And she's played with Gogol Bordello.
I love the fact that I was lampooning Russian culture and all of a sudden it landed me in a...
Is that how it came up to be?
No. I'm going to send you a podcast and I tell
the
whole story
make
about
okay.
how I get in it. But
Right. As far as what it's like to be performing in a lobby, the music is what's most important to me, and the fact that I'm playing the songs that I like with people I respect transforms whatever surrounding I'm in.
So what's your advice to an up-and-coming artist or a new someone who moves to the city and is looking to, you
you know, kind of make it, but balance their morals with their paycheck. You know, what? It sounds like you guys are still wrangling with this after all these years too. But how would you advise someone to deal with this?
There's so many different paths. Some people have it easy. They get their big break early, and then they just.
Right, I went
never
to college
back.
With Adele guy, Ben Curtis.
We went to
he was in my class.
I went to class with Kristen Bell, and she left class 2 weeks into it to go be on Broadway.
Right. Oh, right, Jason Ritter was in your class, too.
Jason Ritter was in my class.
What class was this?
Class of 2002.
Ooh. I graduated a year before them, though.
Oh, okay.
To start teaching early.
I was supposed to be in 2001, but then Mono got me.
But it seems like everyone I know has a day job. They have some sort of security day job from which they pay their rent. They make the majority of their money until their passion project, their skill set starts to make money for them. The other thing, my best advice is to diversify. Get as many side projects as you can. And when one opportunity falls through, it's just a opening for a new one.
I diversified so that I would stop taking non-paying gigs.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, you had to say yes to everything, I would say. But when I crowdsourced, like when that Tyson and Popeye's chicken thing came up, I actually asked a lot of people, like, what should I do if I get this? And a lot of people said, take it and then donate the money to the cause of your choice, to like an animal sanctuary or something like that. So then you're still getting the work, it's on your resume, your agent is happy, your agent gets your 10%, you're still like on a trajectory with your career, but to satisfy your soul, you know, in your off time, do what you need to do.
Yeah. That's hard to tell someone who's, you know, trying to pay their rent or whatever.
Maybe I would have paid my rent and then given the rest to an animal sanctuary. All right. I mean,
right, and if you get a gig that pays your rent, you have a month of free rent off of one day or 2 hours, they have basically bought your artistic freedom. You paid for your ability to grow and create and make art at your will. Whereas if you're stuck doing the day job, which itself could lack integrity or ethics to begin with, if you work at any number of these corporations that don't pay minimum wage.
A lot of people think that in and of itself, being an artist working at a big corporation and then doing your art on the side, even that's transgressive.
Right.
You know?
I think it's transgressive to not ask to be paid, because you're creating a standard, meaning I'll do it for free just to get the exposure. You are, in a sense, making it easier for the people not paying you to not pay you.
Right. I mean, and that's driven down the cost of a lot of people.
At some point, you're actually hurting your peers and the industry if you are not demanding the proper compensation for your time. Mm. Which, that's such a hard line to, like, at what point do you say that? Because if you're starting out, you need to get the exposure. You just need to get the practice and the experience.
It leads to a lot of corporate gigs is what it does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If it leads to work down the line, that's great.
Yeah.
But it's, and that's something I will not answer for anyone else, because everyone has their own process.
Yeah, I feel like there was an era, and maybe I'm just being idealistic, but an era where everyone in New York was like all artistic integrity and all, you know, trying not to sell out and trying to be pure. And that has kind of just become impossible by how expensive the city is now and how hard it is to live here and how much we're all struggling in our various jobs. We're constantly writing stories about how to, you know, how to not be part of gentrification, because it's a big problem in the city, and how to, you know, keep rents down and what you can do to, like, not be part of the problem, because we know that a lot of people read our site are newcomers to the city, and we don't want them to be kind of fall victim to these things.
I appreciate what your WebMag does. It talks about affordable eats, free events, cheap housing.
It's hard though. I mean, I was, you know, I'm sure someone has used my picture to, you know, identify gentrification before.
Are you spring man, autumn man from
Yeah, right. I mean, I try not to be a part of the problem. Like, I love New York. I've lived here for a long time now. I like get to know the city. I'm not just living on the surface of it. I'm like living in it. But it's just hard. I mean, it's just changing so fast that people are skeptical of anything new or different.
My beef is with chain stores. You know, yeah, like right, a lot of the different pharmacies and a lot of the different banks and so on and so forth. They're just, they're impenetrable because there are chains. And not only does that completely homogenize the look of the neighborhood, it also takes away from, you know, diversification and, I guess, you know, local,
well,
local
street
entrepreneurs.
Life. Yeah, and just like street, like Smith Street is going through this right now. Smith Street's not by any means a, you know, a street full of low cost stores and restaurants, but they've had a bunch of closings over the past year or two because the rents are going up so high and the landlords are holding out for national chains or banks or something that will
pay the crazy rate.
Just pay it and then take away that street life that was there or people that were walking between businesses and that
totally.
Sort of thing. So it's hard. I mean, you know. It's hard to, I think it's in that post, it's hard to bring the agency of gentrification down to an individual person because right. I've read some recent analysis of it. It says, like, even the availability of that option to move into that building or move wherever means that, you know, gentrification's already happened. But it's you know, where do you place the blame? Where do you look for change? It's hard to, you know, it's hard to figure out. And I'm not a city planner. I'm not, like, a professor on the subject. I just try to read up on it and like pay attention to it as much as I can.
I don't have an answer. I'm just trying to get by.
Right.
I'm too poor to have an opinion.
but that's the problem though. I mean, it's, you know, a lot of people don't pay attention to these things. They don't think that a building coming down on the waterfront and a huge complex that looks like it belongs to Northern Virginia moving in is a big deal, but really these are the things that are happening that are making things very bland.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, not why everyone moved to the city. It's not why everybody stayed in the city who's from here. So just be careful about it.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, we told our side of the story at least, so you don't think that we're the squeaky clean rich people.
No, no. I never thought you guys were, you know, again.
Which is easy to make fun of.
Yeah.
It's frustrating because you and I, and unfortunately Brooklyn too, is not, we're not in the power to really prevent these things. We can raise awareness and we can influence people, but it's fallen to the oligarchy.
Yeah.
It's fallen to the oligarchy. I love that.
That's my
that's
new
your
album.
Tagline.
Yeah. Well, that's what we try to do is call it out when we see it.
Sure.
Of like, hey, this is a real estate company trying to clearly targeting gentrifiers. They're not, you know, they're not making an event for, you know,
the community.
Like, yeah, for like Ethel, who's lived in Crown Heights for 60 years, to come and like look at a new place.
Yeah.
They're, you know, they're trying to bring in new money. Sometimes, you know.
True.
I maintain a point that your issue is with the people in charge, and I draw a line of my responsibility at the point of I'm hired, I'm playing the gig, I do it well to the best of my abilities. I take payment and then I leave. I don't think that I'm a symbol. I don't want to be a symbol for this realty company. I know that I was the photo that they were sending out.
He didn't even tell me that was happening.
That was not consensual. It's just, I mean, it's probably.
We signed no releases.
I needed the money. And I don't mind about my artistic integrity being called into question because I play a damn good set.
It was a good set.
And if I play a damn good set in a lobby, the next day I'm going to play it in the park.
And then people will kiss.
Hopefully. That's the goal.
All right. Well, we can end it there. We don't think we're going into it. Okay.
Hey, Jennifer, how can we reach you if we're interested in what's happening?
Thanks for asking, Charlie. www.jenniferharder.com. That's harder, harder, faster, longer, stronger. But also, if you want to see Charlie and me together, just go to www.bathtubjen.com, and you can hear our music on SoundCloud. That's linked there. You can see our music video at the Steampunk Waystation with zombies. I mean, I know that's probably giving away the end, but zombies.
And Tim's web mag is Brooklyn, BrokeLyn.com.
And you?
You'll find me on the internet with Neo Bohemia. I'm Charlie Layton, this was Jennifer Harder, this was Tim Donnelly,
Hi.
And this was Neo Bohemia. Thanks for listening, everybody.
And Blunt Thunder presents...